It's 6 past the hour here on Air America Radio, and this is Morning Sedition.
Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, of course, you lurking conservatives who enjoy listening to us go on and on here. Good morning, Mark Riley. How are you?
Good morning, Mark Maron. I'm doing all right.
Are we doing all right? You feeling good?
Yeah, I'm feeling good.
My hair's getting too long for this humidity, man. You know, last night, was it me or was it like stinking wet? Like everything was damp. It wasn't even hot. It rained a bunch of times last night.
Out where I am in Jersey, it rained every couple of hours.
Humidity on top of humidity. My cats are like, I have to check like every half hour to see if they're dead because they're just sitting there like, all hairy and damp and humidated out. My hair's getting too long for this stuff, man. Can you believe how long my hair is? It's so weird. I've not had my hair. I don't know what I'm thinking. I think I'm like growing my hair to make me younger or something. Like, I think that I'm going to go back in time. I actually had this moment where I'm like, maybe I should get those wireframe glasses again.
Here we go.
From my HBO special from 95. I think I'm slowly entering my midlife crisis.
It really is hard to let go of yesterday sometimes.
Man. Oh, yeah,
let go, man. Let go.
Well, yesterday's not so bad, but 10 years ago, I'm letting go, Riley. What am I supposed to do? Am I just supposed to eat pork again and eat meat and
I don't know, man. We're going to have a guest later on that may try and convince you.
The quest for perfect pork. You know, we've been talking about Mad Cow yesterday, and it got a lot of people worked up, got a lot of emails from a lot of different angles. Some people very grateful that we're exposing some of this, some of the obstruction that the administration is putting up in terms of revealing what's going on with Mad Cow. I got letters from doctors saying, I'm not sure you got your facts right. I got letters from people who are like, we need to know more. So I got to do some research, Riley, and we're going to have Eric Schlosser in on Friday.
Yeah.
The guy who wrote Fast Food Nation is on the pulse of this thing as well to discuss it a little bit, because apparently I didn't know this, but it's not definite where the hell this comes from. And this prion-related illness, which is what mad cow disease is, prions, which is what the Creutzfeldt-Jakob syndrome comes from in the human brain, is like this unknown world. And I read some stuff from a guy in England saying that it may have something to do with pesticides. I mean, it's all wide open, man, but we do know it's here.
Well, it's wide open, but, at a point, I got to wonder if you're feeding calves cow blood, if you're feeding cows, ground up parts of other cows, chickens,
sure.
Dried restaurant waste. I don't care whether you get a disease or not. It just doesn't sound right.
Yeah, the bone meal thing and the blood thing, that's all very real. And there's this whole tie into scrappies, I guess is what it's called. It's a disease in England that was in lambs that jumped over to cows. It's pretty rich, and we're going to get into it more in the week. But today, obviously, our focus is ramping up to George W. Bush, the neocon death cult's prime puppet leader, is going to be speaking at 8 o'clock Eastern tonight in a Washington Post ABC poll right now in terms of how people are feeling about Iraq, which is going to be a tremendous focus of the president. He's going to try to feed us a line of BS to make us feel like everything's okay there, but he's probably going to say it's hard work a lot. But according to this poll, barely 1 in 5 Americans, 22%, say they believe that the insurgency is getting weaker. 24% thinks it is strengthening. More than 53% say it hasn't changed. That's a big change in the cultural tone, isn't it, Riley?
Yeah, it is. And those numbers don't bode well for the effort that the president's going to have to make tonight. 60%, 6 out of 10 Americans believe that the country is bogged down in Iraq. 52% say the public was misled about the war. That's up 9% in the past 3 months. And you know what part of that is, Mark Maron?
What?
The Downing Street memo. As it becomes more widely disseminated, people are starting to question and challenge some of the fundamental precepts that the administration has done. But you know what Bush and them are doing, too? And you're going to hear a little bit of this today. I guarantee you, they are still commingling Iraq with the overall war on terror to make it sound as if, even though al-Qaeda is now in Iraq, that the U.S. is pursuing al-Qaeda through the efforts of the coalition forces inside of Iran.
Sure, and we're going to find there's a lot of strange shotgunning of language. There's a lot of, you know, propaganda, quagmire coming out of, you know, Donald Rumsfeld and his standard Rumsfeldese that we're going to, you know, parse in just a couple of minutes. But right now, it's very interesting to me. I've got some quotes here from President Bush's address and subsequent press conference with Tony Blair regarding the handover of sovereignty to Iraq on June 28, 2004. That is a year ago. The status of the insurgency, let's go into that first. This is from last year's address. Bush, a year ago, said, quote, "All this progress is being attacked by foreign terrorists and by thugs from the fallen regime. The terrorists know they face defeat unless they break the spirit and commitment of the civilized world. The civilized world will not be frightened or intimidated," end quote. Just out last week, Brigadier General Donald Alston, chief U.S. military spokesman in Iraq, said this month, quote, "I think the more accurate way to approach this right now is to concede that this insurgency is not going to be settled. The terrorists and the terrorism in Iraq is not going to be settled through military options or military operations." Now, look, certainly I am not one to, you know, I'm not hoping for defeat. I am not trying to, say that I am anti, you know, working this thing out. What I'm trying to say is that we deserve the truth. We deserve some honesty on, you know, behalf of the troops, on behalf of the American people in relation to what's really going on there. That's really what I'm after, Riley.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, look, Mark, a year ago, George W. Bush said, and I'm quoting here, now this was the day of the handover of power in Iraq. And remember, it took place 2 days before they said, I don't know, Bremer.
They were panicking. They needed to do something.
Bremer had to get a flight out. Now, this is George W. Bush from June 28th. This was in Istanbul,
mm-hmm.
June 28th last year. "This day also marks a proud moral achievement for the members of our coalition. We pledge to end the dangerous regime, to free the oppressed, and to restore sovereignty. We have kept our word," unquote.
Mm-hmm.
Now, do people believe that a year later?
Well, that's what they're trying to spin now, too, is that, when we get into Rumsfeld in just a few minutes, and we're going to talk to Borzu Dargahi, who is our guy who is in Iraq right now, to let us know, you know, what he's seeing on the ground and how people are feeling there, because there's a lot of stuff going on right now in terms of how they're going to try and spin this. We've got Donald Rumsfeld, who came out on Meet the Press and also did it in a press conference. He's got job security. No matter how bad he is, he's not going anywhere, no matter how much anybody protests. So what they use him for now is just to get out there and shotgun his mouth off. So everybody who, you know, is, certainly we are sitting there going, oh, man, he's giving us a gold mine of crap here. But that's exactly what they use him for. He's a subterfuge. But I want to get into some numbers. Let's look at some numbers behind. Did I use that word properly?
Yeah. Subterfuge?
Subterfuge. Okay. Let's look at some of these numbers in terms of what's gone on since last year in Iraq. Since June 28, 2004, this is in the last year, 890 American military personnel were killed. The total military personnel on behalf of the Americans is 1,740 deaths since March 20, 2003. 16,000 are estimated to be in the insurgency. That's as of May 2005. Since June 28, 2004, last year at this time, there have been 484 car bombings. There have been 2,221 deaths from those car bombings in the past year. 5,574 people wounded in car bombings in the past year. 52 assassinations of Iraqi government legal or religious officials since April 27, 2005. This is not something that can be characterized as going well. And even in the sense of, reconstruction. Like last year in his speech, Bush said, "Iraq today still has many challenges to overcome. We recognize that, but it is a world away from the tormented, exhausted, and isolated country we found last year." Now, this is from the Iraq Living Conditions Survey 2004 conducted by the United Nations Development Program, concluded, quote, that everyday conditions for Iraqis in the aftermath of the 2003 U.S. invasion have deteriorated at an alarming rate, with huge numbers of people lacking adequate access to basic services and resources such as clean water, food, health care, electricity, jobs, sanitation, end quote. Where did the money go, Riley? Where is the reconstruction? Into the pockets of military contractors, duffel bags of cash, billions of dollars. Where did it go, Riley?
It all disappeared. I didn't get any of it. And what we're seeing now is that the American government seems to have no interest whatsoever in coming to any level of accountability for where that money went. And, you know, they keep asking for Congress for these additional appropriations. Again, I believe, on the backs of the soldiers that are there, because they don't seem to always be fully and properly equipped. But we see the contractors, they're very properly equipped.
Coming up, we've got Borzu Dargahi, who is in Iraq. Also, the Supreme Court rulings, they said, yeah, sometimes it's okay to put the commandments up, sometimes it's not. It's 16 past the hour, Morning's Edition with Mark and Mark on Air America Radio.
Hi, this is Mark Maron's mom, and you're listening to my son and his friend Mark Riley. They're very good boys. It's Morning's Edition on Air America Radio.
Personal injury claim and have no place else to turn for the money. Call Whitehaven Funding at 1-800-559-6805. Call today.
Twenty past the hour. It's Morning Sedition with Mark and Mark.
Hey,
I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley, my buddy. That's Air America Radio. Just in a few minutes, Los Angeles Times correspondent, Pulitzer Prize nominated journalist, and Morning Sedition regular Borzu Dargahi joins us from Baghdad on this first anniversary of the handover of power in Iraq. Right now, though, I think it's important to we get into this. In 10 separate opinions issued today in two cases. In 5-4 rulings, the Supreme Court addressed public displays of the Ten Commandments. Basically said that, if I'm getting this right, now I can't parse legalese, I'm not going to pretend to know what I'm talking about, but if I understand it properly, it's okay to put them up in some places, but not so much in other places.
Well, that's exactly what they ruled. Mm-hmm. I mean, they ruled in a pair of 5-4 decisions on the major ones, one in Kentucky, one in Texas. And what they mainly said was, well, if it is religion for religion's sake, then it's unconstitutional.
No good. So if you have a plaque sitting behind a judge's desk in an office that says that basically says, here are the Ten Commandments, Christ is God, bow down, you heathen. No good.
That's no
that
good.
That seems a little biased, a little blurring of the separation of church and state boundaries.
Yeah.
Okay.
But you can put, for example, a Ten Commandment display on a lawn, which was the deal was in Texas,
mm-hmm.
In the Capitol case. That was that foundation that put up these kinds of things at places all over the country. That, they said, is okay as long as it is not done for an overt religious purpose. Now, part of this is because the Supreme Court has its own religious imagery in its own building and in its own place.
But they have that. That's part of a broader frieze of many legal minds throughout the history of civilization. So they're saying that if you put a monument up of the Ten Commandments or of something of that nature, as long as it's in the context of a narrative honoring, say, the legal history of that state or that region or what, as long as it has a context that isn't strictly religious, it's okay.
Yeah, exactly. And then, you look at the way the court ruled here, and you see that people of varying ideologies. I think on the one hand, Scalia ruled in favor of or voted with the public display of these religious symbols in both cases and issued a very strong dissent in both cases. On the flip side, Sandra Day O'Connor surprised a lot of people by voting the other way in both cases.
Now, yeah.
To say that both were unconstitutional in Texas and in Kentucky.
Interesting.
Yeah.
See, the slippery slope for the Christo Fascist Zombie Brigades is the monument outside. That if you can put the Ten Commandments up and it just needs a context that isn't specifically religious, that gave, within hours apparently of the decision, Christian groups announced a nationwide campaign to install similar displays in 100 cities and towns within a year.
Yeah.
To quote Reverend Patrick J. Mahoney, director of the Washington-based Christian Defense Coalition, one of the primary Christo-Fascist Zombie Brigade units. These are the same idiots that organized the vigil outside the Terry Schiavo Hospice. He said, we see this as a historic opening and we're going to pursue it aggressively. Shouldn't they be out helping people? Now, this is what they're going to put their time on. You know, they've got, now all of a sudden there's this little gap, and they're like, we're going to put statues all over the place. Yeah, that's very Christian. Great. So you're going to be chipping away at granite. Aren't there people that need help? Isn't there some way you can be charitable, empathetic, helping others instead of, protesting people who are fighting for the rights of their family? Or else, now you just like, now get everyone mobilized to build monuments. That's tremendous, you fossiled worshipping hypocrites.
Well, what you have here, Mark, is
I got worked up.
Empathy and charity always with strings. Understand something.
Yeah.
these people, ask yourself, why do they need to have all these religious symbols for themselves? Is their faith so shaky that they have to see it reflected in public monuments? No. The answer to that is no. They'll tell you that their faith is unshakable. In other words, they're not creating these monuments for themselves and like-minded people to see. What they are creating is something that they want to project outward to other people population.
They want to blur the boundary not only between church and state, but with people who aren't religious, is acceptance of these monuments in the day-to-day sphere. I get it. But, you know, their faith may be unshakable, but the integrity of their Christianity is definitely shaky, and their priorities, obviously, very shaky.
Monuments monuments in 106, don't you have anything better to do?
That's exactly right. So let's see if we can get into the other rulings in a minute. I think it's important before we bring Borzu Daragahi from on the air here. He's going to be in Baghdad. He's the L.A. Times correspondent, Pulitzer Prize-nominated journalist, regular guest on our show. He's going to talk a little bit about Iraq, about what's going on this year anniversary of the handover. And also, I'd like to ask him a couple of questions about the new Iranian president, who, before the elections, even went down the neocon death cult, declared immediately that they were rigged. No, that's the pot calling the kettle. So they said that no matter what the outcome, Iran would be ruled by men who, quote, spread terror across the world, end quote. Sounds familiar? What, are they looking in the mirror? Anyways, the winner, I need to ask Borzu a couple of questions, primarily how to pronounce the president's name.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Which is going to be important. But also, you know, this is a guy, he's a hardliner, he's an extreme, I don't know if you would call it conservative, but it's a guy who came up during the Khomeini Revolution.
Yes, and he was one of the people that apparently was involved in the hostage taking back in 1979.
So this guy's a heavy cat. He's a new president of Iran. And what we need to talk to him about also in terms of Iraq is with this Shia majority in Iraq and with this, you know, this conservative presence in Iran, and also the Shia, the main headquarters of the Shia religion is in Iran. You know, what's going on with that alignment, and how shaky is that in terms of what's going on in Iraq a year after the day that we turned over power?
Yeah, and how porous is that border? A lot of people tend to focus on the border between Iraq and Syria and say, well, it's porous, people are foreign fighters are flooding in. Well, what about the border between Iran and Iraq? That's always been a border where there's been trouble back and forth. Obviously, during the Iran-Iraq War, it was a complete mess. Now, with a conservative Shia majority in Iran and maybe fellow travelers in Iraq as well, we'll find out from Borzu Daragahi exactly how all of this is going to get fleshed out, because it's scaring me. It's giving me the creeps, man.
Yeah, it's all coming up next here on Air America Radio's Morning's Edition with Mark and Mark. It's 27 past the hour.
Mainstream media, to the extent that they have any will to do that, they're afraid to challenge.
The Majority Report on Air America Radio.
Past the hour. It's Morning's Edition with Mark and Mark.
Hey.
I am Mark 1, Mark Maron. That is Mark 1 as well, Mark Riley.
Yes.
We are one whole. I don't know why I said Mark 1.
We are one whole?
Because my grandma used to call me that. Yes, we are the whole entity here, friend.
Yes, we are the world.
You and I, the two sides. Today marks the one-year anniversary of the handover to power to Iraq. George Bush is going to address the nation at 8 o'clock Eastern tonight in front of the soldiers at Fort Bragg. He's going to try to feed us a line that things are getting better, that it's hard work. I'm sure he'll say that a lot. He's going to try and spin it on the phone right now from Baghdad. Bear with us. There might be a slight delay when you're listening to our interview. Is Pulitzer Prize-nominated journalist and Los Angeles Times correspondent Borzu Daragahi. Borzu, how can you characterize the mood, the difference in mood between last year and today? I know you were there last year.
I think it's gotten worse in many ways. Things have gotten a little better in some other ways. I would say, for example, it has indeed worked that the police and the army are better trained. The Iraqi police and the army, they're better trained and more skilled. They've gotten on the street. They're out more. The question is, has that affected the insurgency? Have they been able to do counterinsurgency? And up till now, it doesn't seem to be the case.
So the insurgency, according to Donald Rumsfeld, is in their last throes that could last anywhere from 2 to 12 years. I think that's a mischaracterization in terms of his assessment. How about you, Borzu?
I don't think anyone here on the ground sees it as it being in its last throes. It seems to be kind of evolving. It seems to be effective. It seems to get smarter and a little bit more sinister and devious in its ways of getting around the various security mechanisms that the interim Iraqi government and the U.S. allies are maintaining. For example, U.S. Army a captain today was showing me a device that uses like a normal kiss walkie-talkie as a triggering device. And they found it. It's something they've never seen before, and it just shows the level of sophistication.
Borzu, how have Iraqis reacted to the reports here in the States that the American government has been talking to various elements within the insurgency, including possibly Ansar al-Sunnah, which is the organization that claimed responsibility for that mess hall bombing last December that killed 22 people?
Yeah, I think that there's a lot of, I think on the one hand, there's certain people who are actually relieved that someone's trying to make contact with these people and defuse the sort of growing civil war. On the other hand, a lot of others are just kind of outraged. These people they don't seem as having any role in any future Iraq. So why try to make peace with them? And they have a lot of blood on their hands. So they're very concerned about the attempt to come up with a quick fix solution to this problem.
Borzu, are people optimistic at all that maybe these talks can lead to some of these insurgents laying down their arms? Is that at all possible here?
I think it's too soon to say what the reaction is among people. I think there is a little bit of optimism that the interim Iraqi government or the transitional Iraqi government that's in place now can make a difference with regard to getting the insurgents on board. And kind of getting them to lay down their arms, at least some groups of them. But it's such a complicated, multifaceted insurgency that no one really even has a grasp on yet, but it's just up in the air as to whether anything can get it to stop.
Is there any indication, Borzu, that, Donald Rumsfeld said the other day that they don't have a national vision, the insurgency. Is there any indication that the Baathists, the jihadists, and some of the desperate Iraqis that you and I have talked about in the past do have a political vision or are congealing as a collective political movement in any way?
So I think a couple clusters in there do have some sort of political vision. They're acting on a political grievance. But there are certain groups of the insurgents who are really acting out of political motivation. They're motivated because they're criminals. They've done heinous things in the past, and they can't really allow a transparent Iraq to emerge because they would be convicted of their crimes. They're the regime's former torturers. And I think there's a significant and growing portion of the insurgency that's they're just answering the global call to jihad, and they don't really have a political vision so much as a religious vision, and that's the really hard nut to crack here.
Borzu, we've heard reports a couple of weeks back that there were some elements within the Shia community in Iraq that were actually taking out reprisals against some of the insurgents. Is that a fact, and is it continuing?
Well, absolutely, it's happening. You're having this subterranean civil war going on, and as evidence of that, there's these sort of caches of corpses that keep popping up. And for a while, it was only Shia corpses that would be popping up, but now we're starting to see lately most of the dead bodies that we're seeing are Sunni Arabs popping up 10, 20, 15, 20, sometimes with signs of torture under a bridge, in a truck, out in the field, and that's definitely going on.
Let's shift our focus to Iran, Borzudar Gahi, in Baghdad. The conservative mayor of Tehran, whose name that I want you to tell me how to pronounce, has been elected Iran's next president. What are the implications of this for the security of the region and in dealing specifically with the alignment of the religious community of Iraq's majority and Iran?
I don't know if we can make any conclusions yet. This guy just got elected. He's not really one of the, he's sort of a son of the Islamic Revolution, mm-hmm. this guy, Ahmadinejad. We're not really sure what he's about. He's not someone who worked, despite rumors, he's not someone who worked in the security apparatus. He's a, lower middle class kid who kind of cut his teeth in the Islamic organizations of the south of Tehran. These sort of clubs and organizations, and he's definitely a true believer, maybe too much of a true believer for the people who run the government, the more cynical clerics who are really out for a buck. So we should never forget with regard to Iran where the real power lies and where it's always lay is with the Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali al-Khamenei, and although there's been this presidential election, Khamenei supersedes the president and he's still in power. So I doubt anything big will change.
Borzu, do you think that the United States at this point can or should write off those talks that the Iranians have had on again, off again with some of the European countries about curbing their development of nuclear technology? Does the election of this rather conservative former mayor of Tehran mean that those negotiations are going to end up being fruitless?
Let's just wait. Yeah, I think the negotiations are going to continue. Iran has the power. It seems to have a tendency all throughout its history of corrupting all of its rulers, And they all sort of come in with a certain mindset, and they all end up becoming the same clique that their predecessor was. So, hopefully this guy will, come in with all these ideals about Iran and recreating an Islamic civilization in Iran. And then in a couple of years, he'll be, drinking expensive cognac and taking trips to Italy just like all of the rest of them.
Borzudar Gahi in Baghdad. President Bush is speaking to the country tonight. What do you think the U.S. military over in Iraq would like him to say, and what do you think the Iraqi people want to hear from him tonight? Borzu?
I think I'm losing you.
Okay, well, you take care. You be careful, Borzudar Gahi in Baghdad. Thanks for talking to us.
Thanks, Borzu.
All right, it was a rough connection, but I think we got a lot of information out of him. And I think that one of the things we should get into in a minute or two is how Donald Rumsfeld specifically characterized the Bush administration's negotiations with parts of the insurgency. I mean, now we have to, you and I know, Riley, that that Bush's policy has always been that we don't negotiate with terrorists.
Yeah.
And this is one of these angles where, as an American and as somebody who's concerned about the people of Iraq, about the people of America, about everybody involved in this disaster that the neocon death cult has gotten us into, I want to see a way out. And even as Borzu was speaking, people on the ground in Iraq and I myself, even though, I have a certain amount of contempt for the neocon death cult, see these negotiations as a positive thing.
Well, I mean, you can see them as a positive thing, but Mark, think about this for a minute. If you had a serial killer, someone that had, by the way, claimed responsibility for a number of deaths inside this country, let's say in some place in Chicago, okay, went out and murdered 20-some-odd people. And the law enforcement apparatus in Chicago knew who the guy was, knew where he was, and then began trying to negotiate something with him. How do you think people would respond?
I understand that they would be angry, but they'd also, if it was a negotiation in terms of was that negotiation relative to whether or not he would get off the streets or not? Does it mean that he would stop doing what he was doing if they began to discuss it, as opposed to go unfound and continue to kill? I mean, that's a difficult question on the other side of that.
I mean,
these people are up against the wall, and I understand what you're saying, but if they don't integrate some of these people at least into some of the process of government, these Sunnis, this civil war will go on forever, you know, when we're there, when we're not there, and then we will just open this Pandora's box that, you know, we will be responsible for a long time, even though these American officials are saying, well, look, we're just going to let the Iraqis take care of themselves. We have to take some responsibility for what's going on here in the Civil War area. And it's not just that one group. I mean, there's got to be...
Well, no, it's a multifaceted group, but, you know, the Ansar al-Sunnah really irritates a lot of people here because of that mess hall bombing. That resonated here in the United States. It was 22 people died in that mess hall bombing, including a bunch of American servicemen.
Yeah, it's a horrible thing, but, I mean, if this is a war and it's a, you know, as opposed to an occupation, some, you know, these kind of deliberations are going to have to take place on some level. It's 45 past the hour. We'll get into Rumsfeld in a second. We are listening to Morning's Edition with Mark and Mark on Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition, delivering you from evil in 3 hours or less. Air America Radio.
800-357-1473. 800-357-1473. That's 800-357-1473.
Hey, it's 50 past the hour. You're listening to Mark and Mark on Morning Sedition, Air America Radio's morning show.
Yes, sir, you are.
That's Mark Riley. I'm Mark Maron. Let's get the iNews Wi-Fi 5000 headline translator out here
Uh-oh.
And feed it some headlines because I can't understand what's going on sometimes. All right, here we go from the Washington Post. Justices reject 10 commandments at courthouses. Justices reject 10 commandments at courthouses. Translation, Supreme Court says it's not written in stone after all. Yay, that was clever. From the New York Times, panel says NASA still falls short on safety issues. Panel says NASA still falls short on safety issues. Translation, in space, no one can hear you scream.
Oh.
From Forbes, obesity sends health costs soaring. Obesity sends health costs soaring. Translation, fat people no longer lovable. So starting off, it's biennial convention with House Majority Leader Tom DeLay back on familiar ground after bombing at the Indian casinos. Tom isn't the same since his opening act. Jack Abramoff has been out of commission. But among other things, this was the College Republican National Committee biennial convention held at a hotel just out of D.C.
Of course.
And among other things, he had to say this about Democrats. Quote, the trend isn't just about liberal rhetoric. It's about disturbing liberal psychology, a bizarre knee-jerk reflex to assume the world's problems are America's fault. Now, obviously, many of the world's problems are America's fault. All right, first of all, and then he responds to Karl Rove, when Karl Rove said that we liberals wanted to offer therapy and understanding for our attackers, the way he said, quote, that's not slander, that is truth. No, it's not truth. And the bottom line is liberals want to understand what's going on. They want to get the facts in. They want to see what the truth is in order to make an educated and balanced decision about what needs to be done, as opposed to Republicans who don't care what the truth is. They just want to mobilize as many people as possible into an agenda that will benefit them financially as best as possible and keep the population in fear. Am I right or wrong here?
No, you're absolutely right. And this is part of a larger Republican strategy, Moore. You realize who these college Republicans had speaking to them. They had DeLay. They had Ed Gillespie, the former chair of the RNC, the Republican National Committee. They had Bill Frist. They had Republican heavyweights speaking to these college kids. And you know why? Because this organization, CRANK, the College Republican National Committee, raised $12.8 million in the last election cycle. That's why.
Big dough.
Yeah, big dough. They go out, there's 200,000 of them. They're on campuses all over America, and they are part of the shock troops that the Republicans unleash, along with the religious right and the evangelical shock troops. These guys go out and they proselytize the Republican cause.
Mm. It's not about truth for them, that's for sure. But to call us a disturbing liberal psychology, to say a disturbing liberal psychology, let's take a call from Darlene in Atlanta. Darlene, what's on your mind?
How y'all doing?
Pretty right. Good. How you doing?
I was just going to say you want a solution.
Yeah.
To what's going on over there? I was going to say I got a solution for you. Just go on over there and bomb the hell out of them.
Out of where?
Out of all of them.
The Middle East, the entire Middle East, just bomb it.
Just bomb the hell out of them. I mean, you know, we are at war.
Uh-huh. Well, that's a very interesting insight, Darlene. Thanks for your call. But
I guess she must not drive a car.
But no, but the thing is that the liberals have a disturbing psychology to assume the world's worst problems are America's fault. I think we can use Darlene's example. If you want to talk about disturbing psychology, maybe the other side has its whack jobs, too. Would that be something? Am I missing the boat on that one, Riley?
No, not after that. No, bomb the hell out of all of them. Okay.
Sure, no problem.
Level it.
Oh, my God.
Take over the oil fields.
I don't know.
Provoke the Chinese.
That's a bit of a disturbing psychology there.
Right.
You know, but it's a way a lot of people think, you know. It's a way a lot of people, they think that. What I don't understand is, in what part of the brain does that seem like a solution? I mean, because the comparison is like, you know, we dropped atom bombs on Japan, that solved the problem. You killed hundreds of thousands of people. The cost to the world, to the nation, there is nothing but negativity that comes out of that.
Well, of course, but this appeals to the schoolyard side of people's ego. This is something that says, look, you know, we can settle this the way kids settle this in a schoolyard. I beat you behind, I am king. That's what that's the mentality that we're dealing with here.
Uh-huh.
And, I mean, look, you know, there are times when people get emotional, and that's what kicks in.
Yeah.
But in this instance, you cannot govern a country. You cannot have relations with governments all over the world by operating in that way.
So the Supreme Court did some rulings on some other things here, Riley,
yeah.
That we should get into. You know, unfortunately, Noah Feldman is going to be here. Noah Feldman was one of he helped draft the initial interim constitution for the Iraqi interim government. He also has just written a book about the Ten Commandments called Divided by God, America's Church and State Problem, What We Should Do About It. He's going to be on the show in a little while to help us parse some of these Supreme Court decisions, because he is a constitutional thinker.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and these decisions make my head hurt in terms of who voted for what and exactly what constitutes, you know, an appropriate religious icon, a religious symbol on government property.
And sure, in the file sharing, basically they ruled on behalf of the entertainment industry against Grokster and Streamcast Network that they should be found liable for the vast copyright infringements committed by those using software to download music and movies. We'll get into that in a little bit. They rejected appeals Monday to hear the CIA leaks case from Time
yeah.
Magazine's Matthew Cooper and the New York Times' Judith Miller, who had refused to testify before a grand jury about the leak of an undercover CIA officer's identity, Valerie Plame, Joe Wilson.
Joe Wilson's
guest.
Wife, yeah. And this is amazing to me because nobody, no court, has yet explained to the American people why Robert Novak, who was the one who wrote the woman's name in a column,
mm-hmm.
has not been questioned, not been jailed, not been threatened with anything, but two people, neither of whom wrote about this particular story, are now facing 18 months.
And two separate rulings, they ruled that the Ten Commandments, in some cases, can be displayed on government property publicly, and
yeah.
in other cases, not so much. If it's a statue in the context of a broader exhibit dealing with historical motifs that aren't essentially religious, it's okay.
Yeah.
If it's just a plaque on the wall that has the Ten Commandments, and underneath it says, Jesus is God, bow down, heathen, not so good, especially if it's behind a judge's desk. So we'll get into that a little bit. And also Donald Rumsfeld with a scattershot of BS,
yeah.
Rationalizing the administration's negotiation with terrorists, which is something they never said they do. But I'm not sure it's a bad idea. We'll get into that. You're listening to Morning's Edition with Mark and Mark on Air America Radio. It's 39 past the hour. It's 6 past the hour. This is Morning Citizen with Mark and Mark. How are you, Mark Riley?
I'm doing great. How you doing, Mark Barron?
All right, you're listening to Air America Radio. It's definitely 6 past the hour. Sorry about the bad time cue if you're still listening from before. I sometimes look at the seconds and I said it was 39 past the hour. It was only 57 past the hour. So wake up. You don't get 20 more minutes of sleep. I was wrong. I screwed up.
You don't get 20 more minutes.
Some poor guy, like, you know how the alarm goes off and the radio's just on, and he's probably just listening to us, me screaming in his head, 39 fantasy hours. He's like, good, 20 more minutes. And now in 10 minutes he's going to be late for work. I don't know. I just created this character who's having this problem right now. I'm all jacked up on hippie cornbread.
Uh-oh.
Now, what kind of person am I, Riley? I'm a little concerned about my drifting towards a type of vegetarianism that I never thought I would be. I spent yesterday, I'm trying to perfect this recipe of this hippie cornbread. You know what that stuff has in it, bro?
You know, I thought honey, but you corrected me on that.
What does it have in it, Chris?
I'm eating it right now.
It tastes good, right? It's got spelt flour, cornmeal, tofu, maple syrup, quinoa, a little bit of salt. Safflower oil.
Safflower.
Spelt is, I think, a more primitive version of wheat in a way. It's a different grain. It's a harder grain. It's also used in Italian cooking and Tuscan cooking. It's called farro. They use it in soups, and sometimes they use it in breads. But it's a wheat alternative because, as you know, my wife has a wheat allergy, so she's a big spelt person. Now, well, you got a problem with the ingredients of that, Kalo?
No.
I mean, I'm telling you, it's good, but one piece of it is like a meal. There's like a bunch of protein in it, and doesn't it make you just feel like you live on a commune somewhere, maybe in a tent? Doesn't like one bite of it make you feel like you're wearing Birkenstocks and you might be just sitting around chewing on it, maybe putting dreads in your hair? Come on, Chris.
Like I'm living off the land.
Yeah, you're living off the land. Maybe growing. You just finished the spelt harvest. In order to make another loaf of it. You spent the entire year growing spelt to make two loaves of this bread, my friend. That's what I'm saying. Donald Rumsfeld said it may take as long as 12 years to defeat the insurgents, and the Iraqi security forces will finish the job because U.S. and foreign troops will have left the country. That's a pretty big window that he's given himself. The 12-year window there. This guy's unbelievable. It's unbelievable. There's obviously no reason to believe him, but he also said, quote, "We are not going to win against the insurgency. The Iraqi people are going to win against the insurgency. That insurgency could go on for any number of years. Insurgencies tend to go on 5, 6, 8, 10, 12 years." You know, listen to him. Why am I saying it?
In my line of work, you got to keep repeating things over and over and over again.
Sorry, that was George Bush. That was the other guy.
Sorry, they're all part of the same crew.
So, but the lucky number here is 12, and he created this weird window for himself, Riley. And this is Donald Rumsfeld, who is now sort of taking the role as the kind of like the guy who just shoots out a bunch of different information.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it makes it sort of confusing to people. Do we have the sound? Do we have something? Let's hear it.
If you look at the context of his remarks, last throws could be a violent last throw, just as well as a placid or calm last throw. Look it up in the dictionary.
That's Rumsfeld in relation to Dick Cheney's statement about last throws defending. And here's the thing I wanted to hear, I hope.
Insurgencies tend to go on 5, 6, 8, 10, 12 years.
What is he trying to say? The question that is at hand about Iraq on this anniversary of the turnover of power to the Iraqi, the sovereign Iraq, and tonight George Bush is going to be speaking at 8 o'clock Eastern to the country and to the military at Fort Bragg about what's going on there is, what's the plan now?
Well, you know, it's funny. What are they going to say? More Iraqis got cell phones and that's progress? Because that's about the only thing that has gone forward in Iraq since the handover of power. What we've seen, well, yes, there has been an election. There's been an installation of an Iraqi parliament. What have they been able to do? The unemployment rate is still at 40%, which it was just at the time they handed over the power. Donald Rumsfeld knows that the insurgency has not changed, and his major job is to try and reconcile George Bush's, it's going to take a lot of hard work, with Dick Cheney's, the insurgency is in its last throes. That's why he's a lot of last throes. It could be violent. You can look it up. This is the kind of dismissive nonsense that should have got Donald Rumsfeld fired before the end of George W. Bush's first term. I don't know why we have this man leading us as far as the nation's defense and security is concerned.
And he also has to, he's got to answer to the fact, the truth that's been released, that he's admitted to, that, you know, that they are in negotiations with parts of the insurgency. You know, and that was a tremendous Rumsfeldian quote there in terms of answering Tim Russert on Meet the Press, quote, look, you've got a situation in Iraq where you've got terrorists over here, you got Sunni insurgents here, the Baathist types, and then you've got people who haven't decided what they're going to do, and then you have people supporting the government, then you have the government, and the goal is to get people to all move towards the support of the government, and it isn't a matter of negotiating with terrorists. There's no one negotiating with Zarqawi or the people that are out chopping people's heads off, end quote. We are negotiating with people killing Americans, though, and there are 16,000 of them. They are a mixed lot. They are comprised of jihadists. They are comprised of ex-Baathists. They are comprised of desperate, angry Iraqis. And, you know, Rumsfeld said also in his statement, he said that the reason the insurgency will lose is because, quote, there is no Ho Chi Minh or Mao there. There's a Jordanian terrorist who's killing Iraqi people. There's no national movement in the country. They don't have a vision. They're losers, and they're going to lose, end quote. He did not mention that they have a bastardized form of violent Islamism behind them in a war that they think might go on until the end of time. But I guess according to Rumsfeld, that's probably going to be about 12 years.
Well, see, you know, he's sitting here running all of this nonsense. And the one thing he doesn't say, he may call them losers, but can they drag the country into civil war? The answer to that is probably. And Rumsfeld knows this already.
Well, that's the interesting thing, is that the reason they're negotiating with these elements of, I imagine, the ex-Baathists, the Sunnis. Is that if they rally, if as we talked to Borzu Dargahi, our Pulitzer Prize-nominated correspondent in Baghdad.
Friend of the room.
Yes. You know, he said that, you know, at this time there is a sort of a civil war going on, but, you know, are the Baathists, jihadists, and Iraqis who are willing to suicide bomb because they are angry, are they all on the same page? Could they have a political vision? I think Rumsfeld knows very well that they could assemble into having a real political vision with shared purpose.
Well, yeah, and their thing is, we will fight the infidels until we beat them, and then we'll fight each other if we have to. That's always been their watchword here. That's been the way the insurgency has managed to hold itself together. They don't agree on everything.
Absolutely.
They have different agendas here, but they got one common agenda. And that's the thing that Rumsfeld and these people don't want to admit.
Well, we're going to get more into Rumsfeld in a second, but I got to tell you, Riley, sometimes it's not easy being a liberal. We all stray from the straight and narrow from time to time, but when we need to unburden ourselves, we can always confess our liberal sins. If you want to take a turn in the liberal confessional, give us a call at 866-303-2270. But right now it's my turn, so bless me, Brother Riley, for I have sinned.
Thank you, Marin. How can I ease your burden?
What happened?
You gave me enough time.
Oh, good. Yeah. Well, I'll tell you how you can ease my burden, Riley. I was at a protest rally to support rights for transgendered people on Friday.
You mean like women who are also men and vice versa?
Well, yeah, exactly.
Well, you know, that sounds very progressive and compassionate of you, Mark.
Well, I actually just got off the train at Union Square and it was happening, so I'm not a saint. But look, there was this woman there, and... And she had a beard. I mean a full beard, dude. I mean, we're talking like, you know, Hasidic Jew. We're talking Abraham Lincoln here.
Well,
full beard.
That's not surprising.
Really? That's not surprising? All right, and there's a 6'5" guy with breasts. I mean, big breasts, like D-cup breasts.
Interesting. What was your reaction when you first saw them?
Well, I freaked out a little bit. Riley, I freaked out.
You know, I was afraid you were going to say that.
Well, yeah, I mean, you try to be cool, but when you see something like that, you know, I mean, inside I was like, oh my God, would you look at that? No way! I just wanted to stare and point and gasp,
So, Mark, even though you were there to support these people who probably get discriminated against every day of their lives, you couldn't accept them right away?
Well, yeah, but I mean, you know, a lot of stuff happened before the acceptance kicked in. I mean, when I first saw them, I went through a full, like, 45 seconds of denial and repulsion and fear and maybe a laugh or two, some attraction. I mean, some of those transsexuals, I mean, there's something about them. Yeah, anyway, and this all happened before I could make the choice to, you know, just to relax and just see them as people like everybody else.
What if that were you?
Well, I know. It could be me. I mean, but that's another confession. That's another day. Anyway, I would hate feeling gawked at and shocked with shock and fear. It'd be awful. Yeah.
Okay, Mark, here's your pen.
All right, okay.
You have to spend the whole weekend desensitizing yourself.
Again?
There are lots of tranny videos out there.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Yeah, trust me. Yeah. Get a basket and fill it up with tranny DVDs, the 12-hour ones.
Okay.
And I'll bet by the end of the weekend you won't even blink if you see a transgendered person on the street.
Well, you know, do I have to watch that much? What if I start to like them a little too much? And
Is it possible to like something too much?
Everything I like too much, Riley.
Well, maybe you'll learn something about yourself, but if you start to write a fan letter, turn that bad boy off. Now go forth. And sin no more.
Amen. Thank you, Brother Riley. Now, if anyone else out there wants to confess and seek a solution in our liberal confessional, you can give us a call right now at 866-303-2270. That's 866-303-2270. We'll be taking your confessions in a moment. That's coming up next. It's 16 past the hour here on Air America Radio's Morning's Edition with Mark and Mark.
Call us at 866.
Ha! That's awesome. Go on.
303.
Wow, yes. Yes, I love it.
2270.
Oh, yeah, drop the bomb. Drop it. There's not a dry eye in the house. Keep going.
That's 866-303-2270.
Okay, well, just so you know, it was good, but I was also being pretty generous.
This is Morning's Edition on Air America Radio.
973-0190-800-297-3019. That's 800-297-3019.
Past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
It's Morning's Edition on Air America Radio. We're taking your confessions at 866-303-2270. Coming up very shortly, Noah Feldman will discuss the first anniversary of the Iraq handover. Feldman is the author of What We Owe Iraq, War, and the Ethics of Nation Building, and also his new book, Divided by God, America's Church and State Problem, and What We Should Do About It. He helped write the interim constitution of Iraq. We're hoping to get into a conversation about the future of Iraq on this year anniversary of the handover, and also about the Supreme Court's decisions. But right now, we're taking confessions. Chris, listening to WLIB in New York, what is your sin, Chris?
Hey, Chris.
Good morning, Mark and Mark.
Yes. How can we help you?
Well, before the election, I felt very good about recommending and buying Dell computers.
Mm-hmm.
And after the election, I found out that Dell gave lots of money to Republicans, and not only give money to Republicans, but his wife did, and I think maybe even his dog did too.
Oh my God! So the owner of Dell, his wife and dog give money to Republicans, and you were out there recommending Dell computers to everybody. So you you've stopped, Chris?
I still like using them. They're really good.
Oh.
Yeah, I know the feeling.
This is a difficult situation.
Yeah.
I used to have a Dell myself, but I don't anymore. I think that the only penance for your sin is that if you're going to continue to recommend Dell computers, then you have to get involved in some teaching program where you teach people who can't afford to have computers or kids who can't afford to have computers how to use computers.
That would be fine.
Oh, that's the only penance that I can give you, because, you know, we're all sort of hypocritical in the way that it's hard to be completely clear of conscience when it comes to using things. And I understand what you're saying, but you might want to switch. I can't recommend another one because that would be wrong, but I think you should get out there and help people.
Yeah.
I think you could do that. By the way, I saw you at
Hasbrook Heights?
I think we lost
him. He's been shut off by the Dell people.
The government is shutting his mouth.
maybe his wife was like, don't say that to him.
Yeah, right.
He's about to say something mean. Cindy in Florida, what is your sin, Cindy?
Hey, Cindy.
Hi.
Hi. What's up?
Well, here's my sin.
Okay.
Pretty bad.
Mm.
First of all, I cast my first vote in 1972 for George McGovern.
Good for you. My mother did that.
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. And I voted in every election all the way down to dog catcher forever. Mm. You know, felt that was my civic duty. But these last two elections, I voted, of course, for Al Gore, and then I voted for John Kerry. I even worked in the last election as a clerk to try to make sure things went well.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't. And, you know, I'm almost feeling like, what's the point in me going out and voting in the next big election? And I'm seriously thinking about just not even bothering, because I feel like my vote will just not count.
Well,
that's the truth.
Wow, Cindy, this is one of those sins of the mind. This is like a lust sin. This isn't like you haven't done anything bad yet except had some bad thoughts. And I think, hold on to the hope, Cindy. There's only one thing that you could do, and that's what do you think, Riley? Get out there and get involved with somebody you believe in. I still think it makes a difference, don't you, Cindy? Come on.
I'm trying.
Remember now, there have been so many elections decided all across this country by fewer than 100 votes, including one for the governorship of Washington State. So your vote counts. I don't know how to make her realize that, Mark.
Well, you know, the one thing we can hope for is maybe they'll cheat it in our direction next time. How about that?
Yeah.
I like that idea.
Okay. Thanks for calling, Cindy.
Thanks,
Cindy. Take care. All right, Terry, listening to the mic in Madison, Wisconsin, what's your sin?
Hey, Terry.
Morning, gentlemen.
Yeah, how can we help you?
Well, I lay here in bed many a morning listening to you folks entertain myself, and staring across the other side of my bedroom because I listen to you at the ungodly hours that I have to in the Central Time Zone.
Yeah.
I stare at a bookshelf full of paperback books.
Yes.
Carrying such wonderful books by Eastern religious leader like Thich Nhat Hanh and other great works of art.
Yeah.
And I look at them and decide which one should I read next. And there's one that always sticks out that I come across because of its unusual size and color.
Yeah.
It's called the Jerusalem Syndrome.
Uh-oh.
Which I consider a manifesto for all those of us leaning towards the left.
So you have, and what's the sin? You just
the sin is I've never been able to get more than 2/3 of the way through it.
The book of it, you're talking about my book that I wrote. It's like 10 minutes long, that book. So I guess your penance is you got to finish it, and you, and then we're gonna get on the phone and we're gonna discuss it, Terry.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right.
Thanks, man.
Thanks. Wow.
Anyone who's ever bought that book, it's got a small following, but people read it in like an afternoon.
But you know what? I think he wanted you to explain the last third of it.
The last third of it, that's when it gets pithy and kind of, you know what? It is a lot of Marc Maron. And sometimes that can have a draining effect on some people, so I understand him. But who said that? Did you just say that? Did that come out? All of a sudden, did you say that? All right, we got Noah Feldman coming up. Yeah, I am a little draining, and I'm going to talk to you in a second. Did you put on weight, Chris? Noah Feldman is coming up to talk about the Supreme Court decisions and also about the Iraqi Constitution. He's a great guest, and he's great to talk to. We're going to have that and more coming up, Air America Radio's Morning Edition, 40 past the hour. No, 27. 27.
You're listening to Morning Edition on Air America Radio.
Funny man Tom Davis and anti-poverty crusader Romilly Greenhill. Tuesday on the Al Franken Show.
Before past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hi.
Air America Radio's Morning Edition program. Momentarily, we will have Noah Feldman on the phone to talk to us about the state of Iraq and also about the Supreme Court decisions. He has been on the show before. He teaches constitutional law over at New York University. Also helped draft the first constitution for the interim government in Iraq. But first, a little funny. For those of you who are just tuning in, here are a few highlights of what we talked about on the program. It's time for today's Morning Edition Cliff Notes. The Supreme Court banned displays of the Ten Commandments in courthouses, but okays them on Capitol grounds. The justices said it was okay to erect a 6-foot granite monument to the Ten Commandments on Texas Capitol grounds, just as long as it didn't obstruct views of the God Hates Fags water sculpture. Pretty soon you'll have to swear on the Bible just like you did, like just a talking court. Hey, wait a minute. The University of Connecticut is offering a master's degree in Homeland Security. Students can get extra credit for patriotism if they never check out any books on Osama bin Laden or Al-Qaeda. An extremist wins an Iranian election. Mahmoud Ahmadinejad comes from that generation of 1979 revolutionaries still pissed off over the whole Ayah toilet paper fad. Remember that? Bush said the Iranian elections would be rigged by men who want to spread terror across the world. Then he laughed and said, hell, I'm beginning to sound like Nancy Pelosi talking about me. Those are your Morning Edition Cliff Notes for today. Hey, that went okay. Yeah, okay, Riley. All right, man. You go ahead and do the little work there.
Mm-hmm.
Do your outline, do your scribbling.
No,
I know what's going on.
Scanning.
All right, here we go. Noah Feldman is the author of the upcoming Divided by God, America's Church-State Problem and What We Should Do About It, which comes out in July. He's also the author of What We Owe Iraq, War and the Ethics of Nation Building. He helped draft Iraq's interim constitution, and he is a professor of law at New York University. He joins us on the phone now from Maine. How you doing, Noah? Good morning.
Doing great. How are you guys?
All right. Good. Yeah, is it nice up there in Maine, or is it raining?
No, it's beautiful.
Oh, yeah. Wait, you don't have to tell us.
You don't want to know.
All right. So from where I'm sitting, it looks like a year after we handed over power in Iraq that the place is a mess. What's your assessment?
Oh, I think that's exactly right. It's actually worse than a mess. It's a dangerous mess.
Yes, obviously. So now what happens politically in terms of, like, did they have to write another constitution? You know, what's left of the constitution that you put together, and what do you think they need to do with the one that they're working on to make things a little better there?
Well, they've got a deadline of August for finishing a constitution. The only problem is they didn't decide who all the people were who were going to write the constitution until this past week.
Did you get a call?
You know, this time it's really got to be Iraqi, and the good news is that a lot of Iraqis want to be in on the job. In fact, Sunnis who didn't run in the election and so weren't elected to the body that's supposed to write the Constitution wanted in, and that's why it took so long to pick the people, because instead of choosing people who were elected, they just appointed another 15 people to the commission with 10 more people to sort of sit around and be in. So it's a good sign that people want to participate. The problem, though, is now that they've got all of a month and a half to write the Constitution, they've really got only two choices. Either they can take the Constitution that we worked on, the old interim Constitution that's now working, and just make that the Constitution and pretty much slap their own names on it.
Mm-hmm.
Or they can't finish the Constitution.
Which would mean what?
Which would mean they'll take an extension. They can take an incomplete.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and I think they can take an incomplete for 6 months under the interim constitution. We anticipate that something like this might potentially happen. There is the option that they could stick around for six more months. They probably should do that. The upside is that it'll give people a chance to sort of feel that the constitution really is their own document, really is an Iraqi document, instead of, you know, the rubber stamping of the interim document, which was written by unelected people. The drawback is that, A, the Bush administration is pushing them really hard to get it done because they want to be able to say, hey, we got a constitution, let's leave.
And they can't really effectively blame Iraqis for their own problems until that's in place, right?
It'll help. It'll definitely make it less easier for them to say, oh, yeah, these people keep on killing each other.
Yeah.
How does this constitution, or how will it, in your judgment, impact the actual Iraqi government? And, for example, if they end up asking for and getting an extension, does that at all hurt the credibility of this government?
I think it will a little bit, because ordinary Iraqis a year ago were saying, okay, great, the Americans are going to slowly begin to withdraw and we'll get our own government that will do its own thing. And the new government hasn't done much, to be completely honest. Now, part of that's because they couldn't. You know, they don't.
Why not?
They don't have an army. They don't have a police force to speak of. And every time they try to form one, someone goes and blows them up. So, you know, they're sort of closer to being a bunch of guys who stay there, the government, than they are to actually governing. And, you know, it's a slow process to get credibility, and you can't get credibility if you can't actually do anything.
So, what do you think of, there's some factions within the Iraqi government that are calling for the Americans to leave. There are some Americans within the Congress, and certainly there are some military people on the ground that are saying that it's unwinnable militarily, it needs to be dealt with politically. What do you think of the troops need? What do you think of the status of the troops? What needs to happen?
Well, it is unwinnable militarily in the sense that arms alone, our troops alone, can't possibly end this insurgency. It's really clear now that the insurgents can keep it up pretty much indefinitely.
Well, Rumsfeld said up to a dozen years, but that's the cutoff.
Yeah, I mean, he's picking a number out of the air.
I know.
You know,
yeah.
Being, there are the known knowns and the known unknowns, right?
Right, exactly, yeah, yeah.
12 years, he just made that up.
I know.
It's his way of saying a long, long time.
It's a way of getting himself off the hook and giving him a wide berth of breathing room there.
Exactly. On the other hand, you know, it's true that we need the Iraqis to reach a political solution, but if the insurgents think that we're about to leave, then they have very little incentive to reach a political solution, because then they'll just say, hey, we'll wait them out. We live here. You know, we're not going anywhere.
It could end up like Israel.
Exactly. Or potentially much, much worse.
Why do you say that?
Well, first of all, look at the numbers of people who've been killed.
Yes.
I mean, you know, 700 people have died in Baghdad in the last month. And that's only in Baghdad.
Mind-blowing.
I mean, it's really mind-blowing. I mean, Israel, that would be a huge number of people to die over the course of a year.
Mm.
You know, so, I mean, it's really, and obviously Iraq is a bigger country, but it's not that much bigger, you know. So it's a serious concern that if we say we're going to leave or if we signal to the insurgents that there's going to be no more U.S. military there before there's an Iraqi army, that they won't come in politically. So what you need to do is, sadly, is we have to say that we're going to maintain a real presence, that we're going to help support the elected government, and then try like hell to train them to have their own army. But that's also just taking a very long time. And the reason is that we're so busy defending ourselves against the insurgents that we don't have time to train Iraqis.
Professor Noah Feldman, how do you see the government's efforts, the Iraqi government's efforts, to integrate Sunnis who in many instances boycotted the electoral process into this new government? I mean, does that send at all a negative signal to others in Iraq that, you don't have to participate in the election if you're large enough or powerful enough or if people are scared enough of you that they'll integrate you into the government anyway?
It does send that message, but there was no other choice because you've got almost a quarter of the population who made a huge mistake, you know, and they know they made a huge mistake. And if the Iraqis had just said, the ones in the government had just said, well, you know, we're just going to write our constitution without you, then that would be like saying, oh, we're just going to write the constitution without the West Coast, you know, or we're going to write the constitution, you know, without the South or something like that. And it might be morally the right thing to do, but it's not a good way to hold together the country. So I think it's good that they brought those Sunnis into the process. The question is, will those Sunnis be able to speak on behalf of those people in the Sunni areas who are really negative about the government?
And but also, will they be able to speak on behalf? Well, there is negotiations going on now between some factions of ex-Baathist insurgents, which I imagine are Sunnis.
Yep.
And in my head, you know, if we're going to be honest about, you know, trying to figure out a way out of Iraq, that has to happen, doesn't it?
It does have to happen, and it breaks, of course, every principle that we won't negotiate with terrorists.
Right. Except
when they really are able to kill us. Suddenly we will negotiate with them.
Because it's a mistake to think, isn't it, that the insurgency being jihadist, Baathist, and angry Iraqis, general population type of people who are just disenfranchised, that eventually they can't really put together a political civil war momentum that would really could go on forever.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And so what you got to do is figure out if there are some reasonable people on the Baathist side, you know, the ex-Baathist Sunni side, who are willing to join forces with the government and then together get rid of the really disastrously dangerous jihadi types. That may be a failure as a strategy, but it's got to be tried, and we haven't tried it yet.
Right. And a quick last question on this topic. Iran's new president, what kind of effect do you think that'll have on the Constitution, on the state of things in Iraq?
You know, because he's a hardliner, he's going to want to continue the Iranian policy of keeping a big finger in the Iraqi pie. A lot of the people who are running the government in Iraq right now were trained in Iran, spent years in Iran, are very connected to Iranian politics, and the new prime minister, Ahmadinejad, is going to be more influential in Baghdad than President Bush is.
Wow.
Because he's got close ties, and he's got money, and he's not going anywhere either. He's a neighbor. So he and his entire army and his entire nation are going to be there long after we're gone.
Wow, so we really don't know what the hell is going to happen, do we?
We really have almost no idea. The one thing you can say certainly is that President Bush is not going to go down in history as a mediocre president. He's either going to be thought of as the worst president in modern American history or as a really good one, and it's really hard to know.
All right, when we come back, Noah, I want to talk about your new book, Divided by God, America's Church and State Problem, What We Should Do About It. It will be out next month, and there are new rulings from the Supreme Court that you can help us parse into it.
You betcha.
Okay, right. So that's coming up next with Noah Feldman. You're listening to Morning Sedition. I'm going to get the time right now. On Air America Radio, it is 45 past the hour.
Morning Sedition on the air and online. MorningSedition.com. Air America Radio.
Help support our troops in Iraq and Afghanistan. Operation Truth. We were there.
Paid for by Operation Truth, Incorporated.
49 past the hour. It's Mark Maron. Here's Mark Riley.
Good morning.
You're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. Did I say it was 49 past the hour? Because it is.
You
really.
Got it right.
On the phone, we have Noah Feldman, the author of Divided by God, America's Church and State Problem and What We Should Do About It. We are talking to him. He's also a professor, a law professor at NYU, also one of the drafters of the original Iraqi interim constitution. Now, the Supreme Court ruled that sometimes okay to put the commandments on display in government property, sometimes not okay. But yeah, as in response to this, there are Christian groups are immediately going into action to build hundreds of monuments across the country, Noah. So what is this? What does this ruling in relation to the commandments mean, and how does it parse out to you?
First of all, just as a legal matter, it's an embarrassment.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they can't say both that the Ten Commandments are constitutional and that they're not constitutional.
Right.
You know, if you said to somebody, okay, which of these is okay? We're going to put the Ten Commandments in a display with lots of other American historical documents like the Declaration of Independence and Magna Carta going all the way back to 1215, and we're just going to write it on a piece of paper and put it in a display in a building. Or we're going to build a 6-foot granite monument of them and have them stand alone on the State House grounds. If you had to say one, you know, I think you'd say, well, it's got to be that the monument is wrong.
Right.
You know? But the Supreme Court said the exact opposite. They said the monument's okay and that the display in the building is not.
Well, on a constitutional level, why the differentiation in your mind?
Oh, I think there's no constitutional explanation for it. The only thing is that, and in fact, on one side, four of the justices thought that both monuments were fine, the one in the courthouse and the one on the State House grounds, and four justices thought they were both not fine, and only Justice Breyer split his vote in the two cases. So it was 5-4 in both cases with Justice Breyer going a different way. And the reason for it is not constitutional. The reason for it is that Justice Breyer is worried that if the Supreme Court said you had to dig up a big granite monument, there'd be a circus. You know, you'd suddenly get pretty much the same scene you got in Montgomery, Alabama, when Judge Roy Moore refused to move his Ten Commandments statue. You'd have people lying down in front of the statue. You'd have thousands of people out there singing We Shall Overcome. And it might have led to a huge mess. So besides, be political about it.
Well, apparently now we're going to have a circus of Christian groups building hundreds of monuments all over the place.
Yes, which is a good reason that if you're on the Supreme Court, you should stand up for what you believe in and not try to stage manage the politics of the situation.
But no, I mean, is this in part due to the fact that there is some religious symbolism actually in the Supreme Court?
You know, part of it is that there is a, you know, there is a statue, or a frieze at least, which has the Ten Commandments on it in the Supreme Court courtroom, and so they didn't want to say that the one in Texas is unconstitutional because maybe they'd have to get out the chisel and take the one off their own building. But I think it's deeper than that. I think the reason people are so upset about the symbol is not that the Ten Commandments symbol is itself so central to people's religion. It's more that the whole question of whether you can have a public symbol of religion really is standing for the deeper question of how much religion we should have in government. And the people who want this symbol want more religion in government. And the justices who think it's okay think that's fine. And on the other hand, there are people who think we want less religion in government. We just want people to keep their religion as a private matter. And those people think the symbol's bad.
Okay, so now when they say it's going to be a case-by-case thing now, because clearly when you have something that cancels itself out, like you're saying in some respects,
yeah,
and it's going to be a case-by-case issue, does that mean that the state courts are going to be dealing with these things?
You bet. Everyone's going to end up dealing with it.
Oh, boy. So it's just, that's going to be a circus in and of itself.
I totally agree. I mean, you had an interview yesterday that I heard on, I think, on National Public Radio with one of the guys from McCreary County who had put up the original display that was held unconstitutional. And they said, what are you going to do? He said, I'm going to go back and talk to my lawyer. You know, he's going to try to figure out the next thing.
God forbid these people are out helping people that need help.
Yeah, and the Constitution, whatever it means, can't mean that you can't tell whether you can put up a religious symbol or not unless you talk to your lawyer. It should be clear.
So this actually created a slippery slope that that religious fanatics can now surf on.
Well, they're certainly going to try.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's going to be a very hard slog to figure out what the Constitution actually means. And, you know, the result of this is that we're going to continue in this debate in America about how much religion we should have in government. The court did not resolve it. And in the end, the court can never resolve these hard issues. It's got to be the people who resolve it.
You know, Noah, you touched on something I think that's important, the whole idea of public displays of religion on government property. I think, said that there is an agenda there. Can you restate that for us?
Sure. I think the agenda of people who like the public displays is that they want what they consider to be moral values that come from religion to be a major factor in making political decisions. So they think that if we're trying to figure out when life begins or when life ends. We should look to religion. We should be unashamed of saying that our ideas come from religion. And we should use that in the public debate about stuff that really matters, that everyone understands really matters, like stem cell research or the end of life. And on the other side, lots of people think that government should just make its decisions without any reference to religion, you know, that it should make its decisions based on what general reason teaches about these subjects. And that I think, is really the hard debate. And on this one, I think, you know, it's very hard to say which is the right approach.
Yeah, Riley was making the point earlier that by having the presence of these things everywhere, it's going to, even if you're a secular person or perhaps an atheist, it will also provide them the ability to make you get used to the fact that these things are all over the place and begin to accept that their ideology is going to be in government.
Yeah, and I think that's why they'll be pushing for them. They'll be wanting to send that message politically, say, you know, look, we've got enough people in this town who want this display, that we should have it there. There is
right, I hear what you're saying.
Though, the minute they start putting up these symbols, someone's going to get up there and start putting up some symbols that are downright offensive.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the Ten Commandments, maybe you don't want to have them in public places, but no one's really angry at the fact of the Ten Commandments. No one hates the Ten Commandments.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, we live like we do, but we don't actually hate them.
So, were there any other surprising rulings to you that came out yesterday?
Nothing that was really shocking. I mean, I think the interesting decision for me was that they held in, the Supreme Court held in the Grokster case, that file sharing is going to be illegal even when the system doesn't all reside on one central computer like it did in Napster. This is going to make it harder for people to share files, make it harder for small musicians. But it's a big win for the big record companies, which have been trying to fight file sharing ever since it came into being.
Well, Noah Feldman, it's been great talking to you. I'm looking forward to reading the book, Divided by God, America's Church and State Problem, and what we should do about it. I'm sure you explore all the things we were talking about today. Always great to talk to you. Look forward to talking to you again. Take care. Have fun in Maine.
Thanks,
okay.
Noah.
Okay, take it easy. So that's interesting that a guy who is a constitutional law professor is saying that it sort of cancels itself out.
Yeah, the problem for me is this whole offensive that now seems to be
100 monuments.
Yeah, 100 like, monuments in 100 days or something.
100 cities and towns within a year. That's the Christian Defense Coalition.
Yeah, those are the same people that attempted to intercede in the Shiveville case.
Yes, the Christo-Fascist Army Brigades are getting out their hammers and chisels, and they're coming to a town near you to chisel the commandments into the state capitol wall with maybe a stick figure of a Muslim person and a Jewish person next to it. So coming up next, we've got Lawton Smalls on the phone, I'm sure.
Yeah, we got Ham. Ham.
Yeah, we'll leave it at that. Ham.
Blah, 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 blah.
6 past the hour. It's Morning Sedition with Mark and Mark. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Good morning.
You're listening to Air America Radio. Geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, lurking conservatives. We've been talking a bit about the Supreme Court rulings on the Ten Commandments display. Sometimes it's okay, sometimes it isn't. In the case of the Texas Capitol with the giant Ten Commandments statue out front, it's okay because it's in a historical context. But we got a call from Brenda listening in Texas. Hey, Brenda, what do you know about this monument out there?
I know that monument was placed there as an advertisement for the movie Ten Commandments. It was purchased by Cecil B. DeMille, and apparently Texas let him put it there to advertise the movie.
And now look what...
It's a prop.
Right. Now look what's happened. Now it's being politicized and religified. Thank you very much, Brenda, for your call. You know, that's interesting that it was put there as an advertisement for the movie, and now the Christian, Christo-Fascist Zombie Brigades in the form of the Christian Defense Coalition's Reverend Patrick J. Mahoney, who sees this ruling on behalf of that particular monument as being a window of opportunity. Quote, we see this as an historic opening, and we're going to pursue it aggressively end quote, by, you know, mobilizing Christian groups to install similar displays in 100 cities and towns within a year. Unbelievable. Don't they have better things to do as Christian groups than to run around with hammers and chisels and start building monuments to break down the barrier between church and state even more? And then the bottom line is this original monument that this ruling was based on was a movie advertisement. How do you like that?
Prop. What does that mean? Are they going to come to New York and try and build one of these monuments?
I'm probably.
Oh, my God.
Hey, dig this. I got an email here. I keep hearing liberals talk about all the mistakes, quote-unquote mistakes, this administration has made in Iraq. Baloney. When Bush stood on the aircraft carrier under the banner proclaiming mission accomplished, few suspected he might be telling the truth for once. What Bush didn't say was that the mission had little to do with winning, quote-unquote, winning in Iraq, whatever that means. The mission was to transfer $300 billion or more from our pockets to his buddy's pockets. And they seem to be doing just fine, thank you. Mission accomplished. On a lighter side, I wish Letterman would do a spot for stupid vegetable tricks. From our little garden here in Oregon, we recently dug up a potato that looks just like Vice President Dick Cheney. You city guys just don't know what you're missing. Well, that's an interesting thing that he's saying about the money, because we've been saying that ourselves. And in a question posed by an Iraqi reporter just a couple of days ago, President Bush, the reporter said, when does the reconstruction start? And Bush says, what do you mean? We've been sending money there. If you want to get an idea of just how much this war is costing, this is all on the eve tonight of President Bush's address on the year anniversary of the turnover of power of Iraq to Iraqis, a sovereign nation, supposedly, of Iraq that is still under American occupation. But he is going to address the nation and the troops and try to tell us what good has come of it, and also that it's hard work, I'm sure. But listen to this. The Iraq war is costing an estimated $6 billion a month. $6 billion a month. That is the estimated cost of the war for every man, woman, and child in America is about $800 and growing day to day. Do you know what this money could be used for if it was used for other things? The salaries of a thousand teachers in every state of the union, plus the District of Columbia, for the next 25 years. Vaccinations for every child on earth for more than 30 years. The money appropriated for the war so far could fund all AIDS programs worldwide for 17 years. More than 23 million kids to attend a year of Head Start. They could be using it to build more than 1.6 million units of new public housing. It could fund global anti-hunger programs for the next 7 years. That's just an idea of if the funds could be used in a proactive way, what they could be used for, instead of being sent in duffel bags to be put into the backs of trucks of military contractors and not even getting to the place where it needs to get to.
You know, it's interesting. When you look at the question of whether or not they had a plan here, the administration, that emailer may have hit the nail on the head, that the plan had nothing to do with anything military.
Right.
The plan had to do with a transfer of wealth, which, of course, conservatives always holler about like stuck pigs if they're paying out $5 more in Social Security benefits, for example. That's a transfer of wealth as far as they're concerned, not missing $8.8 billion worth of money that was supposed to go to the rebuilding of Iraq.
They're shamelessly bankrupting the country so they can eradicate social programs. And there are guys that will admit that. And a year ago, not exactly to the day, but in a speech that Bush gave, a press conference, this was prior to the handover of sovereignty to Iraq on June 28, 2004, Bush said, quote, Iraq still has many challenges to overcome. We recognize that. But it is a world away from the tormented, exhausted, and isolated country we found last year, end quote. That was Bush a year ago. Now, the Iraq Living Conditions Survey of 2004, conducted by the United Nations Development Program, concluded, and I quote here, that every day conditions for Iraqis in the aftermath of the 2003 U.S. invasion have deteriorated at an alarming rate, with huge numbers of people lacking adequate access to basic services and resources such as clean water, food, health care, electricities, jobs, and sanitations, end quote. Where did the money go, Riley?
It's a very good question. And, you know, it's interesting also, Mark, to contrast the way that America has treated George Bush and allegations that he really kind of fabricated this entire war to the way that Tony Blair is getting his feet held to the fire over in Britain, because now there are new sets of memos that say that as early as March of 2002, he was told that America was getting ready to run this thing up and that the planning was not in place.
Yeah, and we knew the neocons as well in the Pax Americana, which I believe was written in 1995. One of their agendas in trying to secure the Middle East somehow was to go back into Iraq. I mean, this has been on the table for a long time. He just used the death of 3,000 Americans that were killed by terrorists who were from Saudi Arabia and had trained in Afghanistan as an excuse to go into Iraq.
Yeah, and see, this is what you're going to hear tonight. You're going to hear that very subtle. See, because at first they could do it and say it, and they figured the American people weren't paying attention. Now they have to do it more subtly. The linking and the commingling of September 11th and the war in Iraq. Whenever someone confronts them publicly about this, the administration backs up and says, oh, no, we never said the two things were the same. But if you listen to the 9/11 references once or twice during the course of speeches recently, you realize that Bush still tries to commingle these two events for the American people.
Well, I'll tell you, the American people aren't going to take much more of it. In a Washington Post ABC poll, barely one in five Americans, that's 22%, 22% say they believe that the insurgency is getting weaker. 24% think it is strengthening. More than 53% say it hasn't changed. And, you know, people think that now George Bush is more guilty of starting the war than Saddam Hussein. And before tonight, I want to throw some numbers at you, and we're going to lighten things up after this. I want to throw some numbers at you to counteract whatever you're going to hear tonight from the faux Christian blow monkey puppet of the neocon death cult, George W. Bush. Here's some numbers. Last year, June 28, 2004, in the last year, 890 American military personnel were killed. That brings the total to about 1,740 total U.S. military deaths since March 20, 2003. In the last year, it's been estimated now that the insurgency is at 16,000. Since June 28, 2004, there's been 484 car bombings. There's been 2,221 deaths from those car bombings. There's been 5,574 people wounded in car bombings in the past year. And there's been 52 assassinations of Iraqi government legal or religious officials since April 27, 2005. These are disturbing numbers. And there's been, obviously, you know, military personnel on the ground saying that this is unwinnable militarily. We have now the Bush administration, the neocon death cult, is negotiating with members of the insurgency, which goes against what they said they would do, which is negotiate with terrorists. But nonetheless, it might be a necessary thing.
It might be a necessary thing, but we have to ask ourselves whether this unemployment rate, which held at in June of 2004 at 30 to 40%, now it's 27 to 40%, an improvement, I guess, of 3% over the course of the past year. But that's almost half the Iraqi people not working.
Yeah, so it's fascinating stuff. It's going to be interesting to see how President Bush spends it tonight. And we're going to talk to Senator Russ Feingold, and we're going to break that down with him tomorrow.
Yeah.
In terms of how he sees what the president says. When we come back, we're going to have Lawton Smalls from Planet Bush. And if we have a little time, we're going to talk about the new entitled generation. Mm-hmm. I'll explain that in a second. It is 16 past the hour. You're listening to Morning's Edition with Mark and Mark on Air America Radio.
Nothing to lose. Makes you laugh at the troubling news. Sometimes I wonder if he's hitting the booze. Al Franken, King of the Jews.
Air America Radio.
Our estate variation. Call American Life, 1-866-492-2500. That's 1-866-492-2500.
Twenty past the hour, it's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hey!
You're listening to Morning Sedition. Wow. Wow. The coffee has mangled my brain, my neurotransmitters.
Uh-oh.
It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. You all right there, Kalo? Everything okay, buddy?
Everything's fine.
Okay, buddy. Since our president is openly operating in a different reality, we think it's important that Americans know what's happening in his alternate universe. Luckily, we have a staffer who lives in that world. You know him, you love him. Here again, Planet Bush Bureau Chief Lawton Smalls. Good morning, Lawton.
Hey, good morning, Mark. God's the landlord,
and your rant's 2 months overdue.
Oh, yeah, it's a good story. All right, Lawton. That line Karl Rove said about liberals wanting to offer therapy and understanding to terrorists after 9/11 was just so offensive, man, on so many levels. Even you must have been offended, am I right?
Oh, that Rove, he's a master.
What?
That old boy really yanked your chain, didn't he? You know, he's up there with, you know, Jeff Foxworthy or Gallagher. He's hilarious.
What are you talking about? Rove is an irresponsible bully, a power-drawn dweeb.
Oh, you poor sensitive thing.
What?
I thought maybe you're the one that could use some therapy.
Hey.
It puzzles me, Mark, that someone who supposedly makes a living as a comedian can't recognize a joke when he hears it.
Uh-huh.
You got no ear for it, Mark.
Yeah.
What is Banana seeing you?
Right, Rove is the joke, my friend.
Word you're looking for?
Yeah.
Is architect?
Oh, come on.
Frank Lloyd Wright. Me
yeah.
Van der Rohe. I am paid. Karl Rove.
No.
You don't get him at all. Not a clue.
Please, Yoda, teach me. Teach me about Karl Rove, my friend.
All right, here it comes.
All right.
You know how George W. Two-Terms mandate Bush is a uniter, not a divider?
Right. Yeah, okay. I'll go with you. Yeah.
Okay. Well, yeah. Karl Rove is a divider, not a uniter.
Huh.
In a strong democracy, you got to have both. He's like Yang to Bush's yin, fire and rain, Lennon and McCarthy. McCartney. Lennon and McCartney. They're like those twins that are stuck together at the hip with a flap of skin, only not Korean.
Oh, it's Siamese, Watton. Siamese. No, I know. It's an easy mistake to make for him. You know, okay, here's the problem with the setup. Nobody elected this guy, Rove, and we still have to listen to his crap. Rove should just shut the hell up, Lawton.
Well, that's a very nice attitude you got there, Mr. Hiding Behind the First Amendment.
Huh?
Rove's just energizing his base, Mark. That's the problem with you Democrats. You don't keep your base energized.
What are you talking about? What about this network, huh? What about
that?
That
doesn't count. Y'all can't stay energized because you're too busy having gay sex or sucking on the ball.
What?
Sucking sluggish and sloppy. Okay, sometimes I wish y'all would just pull it together so we could have a decent fight, you know? Hitting the liberals like hitting a sleepy puppy.
Hey. Hey, Lawton, I'm just going to let that go, my friend.
Damn.
Tell me this, buddy. Why are we seeing so much of Rove lately? He used to stay in the background where we didn't have to look at
him. All right, I tell you.
Yeah.
That was out of courtesy.
Oh, come
Folks
on.
Folks wanted to know who to thank just to put a face on all those brilliant ideas. He didn't want the spotlight, Mark.
Oh, come on.
It came to him.
Come on.
You can't hide your lamp under a bushel. Matthew 5:40.
Oh, well, good for you. You know what I think, buddy?
Can't hide it.
I think Rove goes out there and he shoots his mouth off so Bush can look more moderate.
No.
Bush is tanking in the polls, so he's trotting out his lackeys to take some cheap shots.
No.
It smells like desperation
to
me. The last throes of a corrupt regime. Things are so bad that the puppet master has to go out there and dance. Go ahead, dance, Rove, you fat, stupid puppet. You're on the way out, my friend.
Puppet!
Oh, my God. You all right?
When I was a kid, I used to have puppets because I didn't have any friends.
Okay.
Kermit, Elmo.
All right.
Howdy Doody.
Okay.
The neighborhood kids would steal my puppets and burn them in front of me for fun.
Okay. Yo, come on, take it easy.
What's going to happen to Bush? They're just going to throw him right in the fire. Rome doesn't care. He'll find another puppet.
Stop it, buddy. Nobody's burning. No one's going to burn Kermit. All right, it's not about Kermit. Just take it easy, will you? Please pull it together, Lawton. I can't let you off the phone like this. Oh, this is bad today. You all right? Wow. Ugh. Okay.
The architect!
Frank
Gehry at the Guggenheim Bilbao.
Oh, wow.
Or Buckminster Fuller at the Geodesic Dome.
Wow, someone's done some reading.
Yeah. I know all I am pay.
Goodbye, Lawton. Goodbye.
God loves you. Down with it!
Frank Lloyd Wright.
Frank
Lloyd Wright.
Someone's been doing some reading, apparently.
Yeah.
So let's see if we can do this real quick. Apparently there's this article we got sitting in front of us that we read this morning, characterized by bitter older folks. The young have been labeled the entitlement generation. This is the new moniker of like 18 to 20 somethings. Apparently, because they're having, according to some of these bitter older folks, a hard time making the transition to work. Kids who have had too much success early on and are accustomed to instant gratification. They want everything the 20 or 30 year veteran has only in a few weeks. But that just sounds like being a kid to me, Riley.
Doesn't it sound like The Great Gatsby or something? It sounds like something from another era. Every generation's elders have something bad to say about younger people coming up. Part of the reason why people are saying this, the older people are saying this about the 18 to 24-year-olds, because the elders that are saying it are part of the baby boom generation who are scared that those younger people are going to come into the workforce, work for less, and push them out of jobs.
Well, you know, entitlement's a weird thing. I think everybody feels a little bit of entitlement. It's just the nature of what America's about on some level. You know what I mean?
Well, yeah.
And everybody, it's like, but that, the scary thing that scares me the most about kids is that, you know, is it's about values, is that it seems to me that, you know, when you have as much corruption that this administration promotes, you know, in the culture, that this entitlement is just this slippery slope, because they know people don't care about hard work anymore because they think it's really about what you can get away with.
Well, it's partly that, and it's also partly the fact that employers don't show a great deal of loyalty to employees anymore either.
We got a weird guest coming up. Peter Kaminsky is the author of Pig Perfect. He's going to join us in the studio and talk about his quest for the perfect ham. I'm not lying, man. It's really going to happen. 27 past the hour, Mornings Edition, Air America Radio.
Mornings Edition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
I love your show and I love your attitude.
I'm going to start charging.
Randy Rhodes on Air America Radio.
Before past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Yo!
Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. Good morning, folks. We've never had a professional anthropologist on the show before until now. This morning we are joined live in the studio by Peter Kaminsky, a proclaimed anthropologist and author of Pig Perfect, Encounters with Remarkable Swine and Some Great Ways to Cook Them. Peter used to be managing editor of the National Lampoon. He's worked and appeared regularly in Food and Wine and Field and Stream. And now he's going to share with us the quest for perfect pork. I miss it, Peter. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I stopped eating meat about 3 months ago for a few reasons, but I'll tell you one thing I really miss is pork. So tell us about this obsession. How did it start? Where has it led you?
Well, after Lampoon, I made a natural career jump to Field and Stream. I got very interested in fishing and hunting as a way of keeping me sane in the Lampoon days. And I used to take assignments down south.
Mm-hmm.
Which to me was, you know, like going to Italy. It was just a foreign country. And somebody gave me some country ham once. And I just got into finding the guy at the gas station who knew the guy at the farm who knew the old lady and blah, blah, blah.
So this was ham that was made and smoked regionally and locally by just regular people.
Yeah, like regular people used to do.
Yeah, back in the day.
Back in the Waltons and John day.
And that led you to what now? You've had this is a lifelong pursuit of yours, though, in some respects, isn't it?
Well, it is. It really started when I was a kid. My grandma used to have a grocery store in Kearney, New Jersey.
Sure.
And she used to get on the 29 bus in Newark and come up to our house and bring me tasty cakes and baseball cards and boiled ham.
Wow.
And I just thought that all makes one big good thing, so I still like all of them.
What does the perfect ham taste like there, Peter?
The perfect ham tastes silky and smooth and smoky and nutty and surprisingly a little bit fatty. That's where it gets the good taste. The,
uh-huh.
the fat's not bad for you if you raise it right.
How is that possible? Wait, I'm sorry,
yeah.
Riley. I've heard nothing that says that fat's good for you, especially pork fat.
Well, remember in Sleeper when Woody wakes up and he finds out the cholesterol's good for you?
Yeah.
That happened to me in Spain. In the west of Spain, excuse me, you see this basically a golf course. It's just grass and trees for 400 miles. And the pigs have been raised that way, raised on that land for like 700-800 years. And what they do is they eat grass and they graze on acorns. And an animal that eats acorns, like a pig, will have fat that's 55% monounsaturated.
No, I have
it's like
no
eating
idea.
Eating salmon with... Yeah.
But, you know, the pig that most people eat here, I don't think have been raised on grass. I mean, isn't there like a pig industry? Don't they kind of raise pigs on cow's blood and stuff like that?
Well, the pigs that are raised here are inconveniently allowed to be alive, I think, is the way most producers would look at it. They're raised in what are called hog factories, by and large. That's what's taken over American agriculture. They're raised the way Tyson raised chickens.
Mm,
these,
yeah.
I call them Auschwitz for pigs. But they never can lay down. They're pumped. They never see the outdoors. They never see the sun. They're pumped full of antibiotics. And they're raised for about 6 months. So the combination of no exercise and killing them, you know, before they're teenagers, basically, means you have thin, insipid-tasting, antibiotic-full meat. And that's part of the reason I got so interested in pork, because I've always loved the taste of it. But I hadn't been able to make a good pork chop for 25 years, and I was always beating myself up about it. But I think it's more the quality of the meat that's available to most of us.
So you're saying, because, you know, we were talking about mad cow disease here the other day, and I've recently got some emails from organic farmers, you know, who I think are sort of thinking along the lines of where you're leading this conversation, in that there is a respectful and healthy way to treat animals and also create a meat that isn't dangerous.
Well, it's unfortunate, but I think mad cow is payback time for the faulty farming practices that we've had in this country. Animals should eat what they were born to eat.
Mm-hmm.
Pigs should eat grass and acorns. Cows should eat grass. You feed things, stuff they don't eat, they didn't evolve to deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
And you chop up the unspeakable stuff they chop up into bone meal, and I'm not surprised.
Now, Peter, so far our discussion has been largely clinical, but you really, got passionate about this to the point that you drove 23 pigs from point A to point B. How in the world did you manage to do that?
Rent a truck. What happened was, found these great pigs in Spain. I came back to America and started studying about farming. And I found out that we used to raise, Americans used to raise pigs on acorns, a natural forest environment, for hundreds of years, until the corn industry and railroads allowed us to do it in a more confined, quick weight gaining way. So anyway, Columbus brought over a mess of pigs to America. Spaniards brought pigs wherever they went.
Mm-hmm.
They would drop them, and they'd have more pigs when they got back, when it was time to conquer it and throw out the Indians. So they dropped a load of pigs on Asabaw Island, a little island off Georgia, about 500 years ago, and never had much reason to come back. It's quite a pretty island, but it's full of mosquitoes and snakes. It's not
and pigs?
Sort of.
And now pigs.
Well, up until very recently, thereby hangs a tale.
Uh-huh.
The government said, you know, these pigs are dangerous to the loggerhead turtles, so we're going to shoot all of them, this breed of pigs.
That have been there for
500 years.
Wow.
And I'm going, well, the turtles are still there. You know, they can't coexist. But anyway, I found out that the NIH was using these guys for diabetes research.
National Institutes of Health.
Correct. And so while doing a tailgate story for the New York Times out at Arrowhead Stadium, I found this NIH facility, and they had a mess of these pigs that they were sort of like stuffing with junk. They were supersizing them.
The last of the Columbus pigs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And so $100 a pig. And some help from a professor, Chuck Talbot, at North Carolina A&T.
Oh, yeah. That's an agriculture school. That's agricultural
sure
and technical.
Yeah. And Chuck had a grant to get limited resource farmers off of tobacco and onto, you know, something, well, he called it niche pork, high-end niche pork.
Niche pork.
niche pork.
Super swine.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So anyway, we went and he helped me, and Paul Willis, the founder of Nyman Ranch Pork Company, a great naturally raised outfit, co-op of many family farms. He sort of helped us too. We loaded up these pigs. We drove them from Columbia, Missouri to Columbia, South Carolina.
Wow.
Where we found a couple of farmers there and in North Carolina. We said, well, we'll raise these guys outdoors, you know, the old-fashioned way.
On just what they're supposed to eat naturally.
Exactly.
Uh-huh.
And so that's what they did, and I went down and kept visiting my girls. They were all girls. All through the fall, they got big and chubby. Apparently, they enjoyed themselves outside. And then came Judgment Day, and we had some wonderful pork chops. And to this day, we're eating the hams, and they're just spectacular. No.
Now, apparently, one of the friends of our room was involved in this, Daniel Balut.
Uh-huh.
You remember Daniel?
Daniel from Daniel's Restaurant.
Yeah.
Daniel's my old buddy. We've done a couple of books together.
Yeah.
And he and I had taken what I call the 100,000-calorie tour of France a few years ago and ate our way across farms and restaurants.
I want to eat meat again.
See, now you're good.
So I told Daniel, in fact, you tell any chef, Daniel was like one of the first to jump on. But you say pig, the whole kitchen gets happy. They like,
really?
Nothing like better than taking apart a whole pig and serving it all.
They break into pig chuckles.
They do. They do.
They get giddy with piggy.
Wow.
So yeah, but he cooked some of that. I think we had some pork that night, didn't we?
No, I didn't.
I know, but I was still eating it then. This is a stupid question, but don't you develop an emotional attachment to these pigs that you ran across the country and brought up and fed these girls that you called them?
Yeah, your girls.
Were you sad to eat them? Was there a moment of emotional, you know, sadness?
Surprisingly not.
They tasted good.
Yeah. I mean, while they were alive, you try and take care of them. They were cute and all that, but... I thought it would bother me, but it didn't. So maybe I'm not the emotional softie I thought I was.
Well, maybe you are just in other ways. Now you said that. Just tell me something. Something's hanging with me about this corn thing. The shift into corn enabled the agriculture business to sort of become what it was. What don't I know about the corn industry or feeding by corn?
Well, interestingly, the first thing you should know is nothing evolved eating corn. Mm. Nothing on earth.
Because nothing?
Corn is an invented product.
Really?
Yeah. Corn was is a hybrid whose invention is lost in the mists of time. But it happened sometime in the last 10,000 years in Mexico amongst the so-called primitive folk,
mm-hmm.
who are pretty advanced agronomists. So it's already a made-up feed. Now, I'm not against corn. I like it. But it's one of these made-up things that really is very prolific. You can pretty much grow it anywhere, like fast-growing pigs. It just sort of gets high as an elephant's eye
mm-hmm.
In a few months. And American agriculture is, I don't even know what the figure is. After marijuana, it's probably the biggest cash crop.
Sure.
And the corn that we don't eat, we feed to animals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And in order to make all that land arable, that is farmable, it requires a lot of petroleum fuel to fertilize the fields, to transport the corn, to transport the animals, to process the animals.
Mm.
So in one way or another, not only are we raising animals on corn, we're raising them on oil. American agriculture runs on oil. We're eating oil.
Oh, God.
God. Here I thought it was just the corn or safflower or whatever.
And now they
oil.
Have genetically modified corn that's evolutionarily different and taking over old crops of corn.
Yeah, that corn's going to tell you like those, you know, you thought the pigs were. I feel bad about you killing me. They're going to, you know, modify some consciousness into it.
It's getting complex. The book is Pig Perfect, Encounters with Remarkable Swine and Some Great Ways to Cook Them. Peter Kaminsky has been our guest. It was a very exciting, intelligent, and nice yarn you spun there, Pete. And I'm excited to finish up the book.
Hey, absolutely.
Thanks for being with us. It's 45 past the hour. You're listening to Mark and Mark on Morning's Edition, Air America Radio.
Hi, this is Terry Jones from Monty Python. If you're like me, you're tired of having geeks and dogs repeat things you said 30 years ago back to you as if you don't remember saying them and then laughing as if they think they're so damn clever. I mean, wow, you memorized a 30-year-old movie? Oh, good show, old chap. Oh, great. Be president of the United States. Come on. And now for something completely different. It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
800-297-3019. That's 800-297-3019.
All right, it's time to put this thing down. It's 50 past the hour. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Yo!
It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. No, we've got a guest that comes in here every so often, once a week, maybe once every couple of weeks. You know, we get into talking about, you know, the important issues with, and I just wanted to replay this broadcast of an interview we did with Sammy the Stem Cell from last week to sort out some of the controversy surrounding stem cell research and whether or not Congress will provide more federal support. We have a special guest. Sammy the Stem Cell, welcome, my friend.
Hi, I'm Sammy the Stem Cell.
Hi, Sammy.
Hi, Mark.
Okay.
Hi.
Hey, how you doing, buddy? Look, before we start, I think we should read an email complaint one of our listeners sent concerning you, Sammy.
All right, give me your best shot, Slick. Bring it on. It's go time.
Okay, here we go. It reads,
quote, I am a librarian and I'm all about freedom of speech, but to give you a little feedback, the Sammy to Stem Cell bits are worse than offensive. They're just not that funny. They're just really adolescent. I feel embarrassed for you when I hear them. Not funny. Signed, Dina M. You have an answer for that, Sammy?
Yeah. Try looking up my response in the I don't give a crap section of your local library.
Oh, no.
Adolescent my ass. This is outrageous. I have a degree in art history, you know.
I didn't know that. You don't think that she has a valid point, though, Sammy?
No, look, you kale munching hippie.
Oh, man. Come on.
It's obvious this chick hates my freedom.
Oh, no.
But worst of all, Mark, she hates life. Yes, I'm a unique, living, integrated human person. Don't forget that, you dumb heap.
Hey. I don't think it has anything to do with her hating freedom, Sammy. She has a right to... Wait a minute. Did you just call me a dumb heap?
No, that was Kalo.
No, you're a monster, man. A monster.
You're welcome, Shylock.
Hey, wait a minute. Jeez, you are so disgusting. What is your problem? What the hell makes you tick?
I don't know. You know what? It's a long story, Mark, but maybe I can say it in a song.
Okay.
I'm Sammy the Stem Cell. I hope you never get well. I'm Sammy the Stem Cell. Hey, Mark.
What?
Go to hell.
Oh,
I'm Sacred Life. I did your wife.
Oh, no.
I'm Sammy the Stem Cell. Dum doo dee dum dee doo. I'm Sammy the Stem Cell. Hey, Mark.
What?
You! Everybody! I'm Sacred Life. I did your wife. I'm Sammy the Stem Cell. Doodly-dum-dee-doo. Shut up, Riley.
Hey! So I never liked you.
So you think that...
Let me stew myself.
Oh, boy. So you think that Congress is... Is he going to vote to fund more stem cell research here, Sammy?
Well, that's a good question, Mark.
Uh-huh.
So far, the bill has broad bipartisan support in the Senate, and they could vote it on by next month. However, all indicators point to a veto by President Bush. It's an important story, and I'll keep you posted on it.
Wow, Sammy, that was sincere, straightforward, and completely devoid of vulgarity or insults. I'm proud of you, man.
Exactly the kind of crap I'd expect from a freak bag like you.
You know, you make me hate all stem cells.
Yeah.
Why don't you just leave, my friend?
Read my mind, a-hole. So long, Diplong.
All right, we'll see
you. I left 5 minutes ago.
You're the worst.
Wow.
That was Sammy the Stem Cell from last week. I was listening to myself laugh on that tape, and there were points where it sounded like I was about to cry. I'm very critical of myself when I hear myself on reproduction, you know. Look, I guess four heirs of the Walmart fortune just got richer yesterday because John Walton, the son of the Walmart Stores Incorporated founder, Sam Walton, died yesterday in a plane crash near Jackson Hole Airport in Wyoming. He was the only person on board of the plane. He was 58 years old. I guess it was, I don't know where he was flying. But billions of dollars.
Yeah.
I assume that the grief of the siblings was tempered by the billions more dollars they will be getting.
Well, I don't know. He was worth $18.2 billion. The man apparently was a Green Beret during the Vietnam War. Actually was running the holding company for True North Partners, which was based in Bentonville, Arkansas.
Are you hearing that music?
I'm hearing it. I don't know exactly. You know, some people have no heart. I can say.
There must be some bleeding from another station.
Yeah,
I don't know what's going on. It's kind of coincidental, though, that it would be Buddy Holly.
Is CBSFM back?
I don't know. I guess so. Maybe we're picking up the feed from the oldie station.
The oldie station, yeah.
Wow, that's a weird coincidence.
Wow, well, either that or someone's got a real bad attitude.
Is there a God? What is going on? Someone's got a sense of humor. All right, so look, we still got more time to talk there, Riley.
Well, we do have some more time.
We got to, you know what? Fortunately, that's so funny I just said that. It's like, well, what are we, how come we're talking on the radio? Look, folks, what a weird thing. What's that? Like, it's like I know my mouth has to keep moving, and it wasn't quite clear what needs to be coming out of it. So I'll just draw to everyone's attention that there's still some more talking to do.
That's right.
Because
still got
it is a talk network, and we are a talk show. How do you like that?
Yeah.
It's amazing how much time I'm wasting as we speak, isn't it? Speaking about speaking. For those of you who are just tuning in, here are a few highlights of what we talked about on the program. It's time for today's morning's edition Cliff Notes. The Supreme Court banned displays of the Ten Commandments in courthouses but okayed them on Capitol grounds. The Ten Commandments can be displayed outside the Texas State Capitol. They cannot be displayed inside Kentucky courthouses, but burning crosses can still be prominently displayed on black families' lawns. Yes. The University of Connecticut is offering a master's degree in Homeland Security. Most of the program will be offered online, with students required to hack into the curriculum database. That's funny. Come on, that's a funny one. An extremist wins an Iranian election. The Bush administration claimed the election was rigged, citing as proof a written request from Iran asking Bush the best way to do it. U.S.-Iranian relations may be strained with a hardline religious zealot in charge, and it's even more complicated now that Iran has the same thing. Today's phrase, just drop it into conversation. How can Bush deny global warming? Wake up, sheeple. The world's glaciers are melting faster than support for the war. There you go. That's your morning's edition clip notes for today. You okay, Riley?
Yeah, man, because tomorrow, you know. Now, tonight, Bush is going to speak.
Oh, yeah.
And tomorrow, we're going to parse the arse.
Yes, we have. Good. And we're going to have Russ Feingold on, Senator from Wisconsin, to help us with that.
That's right. And Gary Young is going to tell us about racism in America and his recent trip to Philadelphia, Mississippi. And there'll be a certain comedian coming by to hang out as well.
Is it Robert Klein tomorrow?
I think it's tomorrow.
All right, buddy.
Have
good
a
show.
Good one. Air America Radio.